black hole entropy from soft hair. And I guess the place to start is, first of all, with an acknowledgement. This is work that was done variously with Andy Strominger. Sasha Hayko is one of my graduate students, and Stephen Hawking before he passed away. In fact, the work started off at a country house where we were just simply having a lunchtime lecture from Andy. There were about, maybe even Neil was there, I can't remember. You were there. And we decided to have it outside, and almost everyone fell asleep during Andy's lecture. And although his lecture was about the BMS group, I couldn't understand why it had to do with things happening at infinity, and neither could Stephen, and that's where the work started. We simply said, well, this seems to apply everywhere, not just sort of up there, but it could be down here, it could be on the black hole horizon. So that's how this work started. So I think the first place to start would be to ask ourselves why we believe that black holes have an entropy in the first place. And the answer to that comes in three parts. The first is the first law of black hole mechanics. This is a classical theorem, and in a certain sense, it's related to the fact that there are black hole uniqueness theorems. I'm only going to deal with asymptotically flat spacetimes. And under those circumstances, we believe that stationary black holes are characterized by the mass, its angular momentum, and its charge, and nothing else. The metric depends only on those up to diffeomorphisms. There are some derived quantities that you can get from these things. There's the area of the black hole horizon. Let's call that A. There is an electrostatic potential of the horizon. Let's just call this phi. There's the angular velocity of the horizon. Let's call that omega. And lastly, there is the surface gravity as measured on the horizon, kappa. There is a theorem in classical general relativity which tells you about what happens if you make an infinitesimal change to a stationary black hole and wait for it to equilibrate to a further stationary black hole. And it tells you about the energy change. dm is equal to kappa dA over 8 pi plus phi dq plus omega dj. So this looks awfully like the first law of thermodynamics. This tells you that a certain amount of work has been done by changing the rotation of the black hole. This tells you that a certain amount of energy has been put into the black hole by changing its electric charge. And this term looks geometrical in nature. However, Hawking discovered, quite famously, that the temperature of a black hole was kappa over 2 pi. And I'll call that TH for T Hawking because we'll have some other T's later on. And that meant that you could say this really is the first law of thermodynamics. Provided you identify the area of the event horizon with the entropy, S is equal to a quarter of A. Like everyone else in the field, I'm a little bit lazy and use natural units wherever I can. But if I didn't, and I put h bar back in, there's an h bar there, and a 1 over h bar here. And of course, you retrieve classically the result that the black hole has zero temperature, it doesn't emit anything, and its entropy would be infinite, indicating the fact that nothing depends on how the black hole was formed. A second reason to believe that there is a black hole entropy is what's usually called the second law of black hole mechanics. Suppose that you make an infinitesimal change to a black hole by throwing something in that has positive energy. Then it says the change in the area of the event horizon is greater than or equal to zero. And since you believe that the entropy is the same as the area, this thing is essentially the same thing as the second law of thermodynamics. There is a third reason to believe that black holes have an entropy, and that is, and I'm sure Neil will forgive me for this, the Euclidean derivation of black hole entropy. So in this, what you do is you say, well, let's just look at it for the Schwarzschild case. It generalizes to the Kerr case quite easily. You start off with the Schwarzschild metric. And then what you say is that I'm going to try to compute the partition function for this system in the usual way. I'm going to say the partition function in the canonical ensemble is e to the minus free energy over temperature. And that's the same thing as the integral over all metrics of e to the minus action. But here you mean all metrics that are periodic in imaginary time. So if you send t to I tau, several things of interest happen. The metric becomes ds squared is 1 minus 2 mr o d tau squared, plus the same thing to the minus 1 dr squared, plus r squared d omega squared. And you'll see that this only makes sense for r greater than 2m, and that tau must be identified with period 8 pi m. You can estimate this. There will be a classical saddle point corresponding to this Euclidean field configuration. And so if you start from the action, which is going to be minus 1 over 16 pi times the integral of r square root of g d4x, I guess plus because it's Euclidean, minus 1 over 8 pi k, an important surface term, depending only on the metric on the boundary, and a counter term, this being the second fundamental form on the boundary, here in the honest space-time, and here in flat space, so this is the Gibbons-Hawking counterterm. And this is really the York boundary term. Then you can evaluate I, and you simply get a tree-level contribution, and you will discover that F is equal to M over 2. But you've done something strange here. Because r is greater than 2m, you have effectively removed the interior of the black hole. In other words, you have traced over all of the interior states. Whatever they may be. And if you say that F is equal to M minus TS, you'll recover that S is equal to a quarter A. But whilst I only sketched how to do it for Schwarzschild, the same thing will work for the Kerr-Newman sequence of solutions. But you'll notice that when I wrote up the action there, there was the obvious bulk term, there was a correction term to the boundary, and a counter term, which is needed to make you have sensible answers, in this particular case, answers that do not diverge. So that's why you believe there is a black hole entropy. But the black hole uniqueness theorems will seem to be telling you something else, because the entropy is supposed to be equal to the logarithm of the density of states, according to Boltzmann. But we already have the uniqueness theorems. So there is some tension there that needs to be resolved. Now let's say a few words about soft charges. I'll do this discussion in electrodynamics because it's a lot easier than doing it for gravity. So let's look at the conformal diagram of Minkowski space to start with. So here is scri plus, scri minus, I plus, I zero, and I minus. And recall that I zero is potentially singular in pictures of this type. Now, suppose I was interested in Maxwell's equations with some currents. So these would be sources of the electromagnetic field. And I ask myself about the behavior of the electromagnetic field close to infinity on these null surfaces, scri plus and scri minus. What I will discover for arbitrary collections of currents, as long as they don't extend out to close to I zero, space like infinity, in other words, they're sort of in the interior of the space-time, then I will discover that the electric field, FUR times R squared, at this point, remember that U is a nice retarded time coordinate up scri plus. Similarly, there'll be a nice advanced time parameter V up scri minus. This thing will in general be some function of theta and phi. It turns out that independently of what this is, I want to evaluate this. Let me tell you where I want to evaluate this. I want to evaluate it at the past endpoint of scri plus. It turns out that this is equal to R squared F of VR, the electric field radially, at pi minus theta, phi plus two, phi plus pi, evaluated at the future endpoint of scri minus. This just simply follows from the basic character of the Leonard-Veitch potentials and was in principle, but not in practice, discovered in around 1900. So what this tells you is that, let's magnify this point a little bit. It tells you that the electric field here is the same as the electric field here, but at the antipodal point. So E here and E here are the same, except that you have to take the antipodal point on the sphere at scri plus and scri minus. You can turn those into charges. So let's call this Q epsilon plus.
Retarded.
It doesn't actually make any difference. It works for anything. It works for any Green's function, but I chose. If you want to do it for yourself, you're better off using retarded. So you can calculate a charge here. epsilon is any spherical harmonic. So this is calculated at the past endpoint of scry plus, which I'll write as scry plus minus. It's going to be the same as a charge I'll call Q minus epsilon, which is epsilon P star F, where epsilon P means the antipodal transform of this one. If epsilon is equal to 1, I guess I should say this is scry plus minus, scry minus plus. If epsilon is equal to 1, this is just simply the conventional electric charge. But what this is telling you is that there is a conservation law at every angle. Not just that there is a conservation law for the conventional electric charge, there is a conservation law for all of these moments of the electric charge. You can define fluxes by, where's the eraser? Do we have an eraser?
On the ledge up there.
Ah. I could construct a Cauchy surface that looks something like this, close to scry, goes past I0 and comes down like here. Call this, it doesn't matter what we call it really. You can construct a section of this surface here. So this thing would be a two surface, and I could measure Q epsilon U here in terms of what you have here, Q epsilon plus delta Q epsilon. The difference between these two is just going to be given by, from here, applying Gauss's law, d epsilon star F plus epsilon d star F, otherwise known as star J. So that tells you how to calculate a flux through here, and allows you on any section of scry, or even at I plus, to define these charges. So this formula defines charges asymptotically at any instant of retarded time, including the infinite future I plus.
Are they just the multipoles of the charge distribution?
No. No, they're not, because those die off like higher powers of 1 over R.
Oh, you multiply them by R.
R squared.
Yeah.
I guess I should have said that this should have had an R squared in it, shouldn't it?
So, are the multipoles multiplied by R squared?
Yeah. So charges we have at any instant of retarded time, including infinity. Now let's ask ourselves, yes.
Excuse me, so how is in this equation then epsilon extended into a function?
I just regard it as, it's just any spherical harmonic, independent of R, so it's just a function of theta and phi.
And no function of U.
No function of U. Now ask yourself what happens in a black hole space-time instead. In a black hole space-time, typically formed by collapse, I'll just do eternal black holes because it's a lot easier. you have a picture that looks like this, and you still believe that there is an antipodal map between electric charges there and there. So what does the conservation law now tell you? It tells you that if you sum up the charges that enter the space-time like that, they've got to be the same as the charges that leave the bit of space-time that you're going to observe like that. And those are the two surfaces in question. So the charges in here must be the same as the charges out at Scry plus, union I plus, union the horizon. That works because in the case of gravitational collapse, this is a point where nothing is happening, so you don't get any contribution from that. And so the whole collection of charges must be given by an integral over this surface. So for the black holes, there will be soft charges on any section of the horizon. So that's essentially what a soft charge is. So how do we do that for gravity? Well, I'm going to forget about what happens at infinity and just concentrate on the physics of the black hole for the moment. And ask, how do you compute charges in general relativity? Yes.
Gibbons, among many others, have shown that black holes are not expected to have electric charge because of string effect production. Vacuum annihilation is simply neutralized. Do we worry about the physics?
I'm not worried about white holes here. I'm only interested in black holes. And I did the case of eternal black holes formed by gravitational collapse that's never going to evaporate completely. We could do evaporating black holes, though that would be rather more adventurous, isn't where we're going in this seminar. But
astrophysical bodies don't have electric charge.
Astrophysical bodies generally do not have electric charge.
So
it's just using it as a model.
Mathematical
model.
Yeah. But now we're just going to do gravity from here on, so we don't need to worry about electric charges anymore. Yes?
Is the antipodal mapping, that matching, does like a boundary condition come into that? Can I think of it?
No boundary condition. The only thing that you have to have is assume that the electric charges that give rise to this are in the interior of the space, so that J will fall off sufficiently fast as you go off to infinity.
Regardless
of what boundary conditions you pick. So let's ask how you define charges in gravity. So I'm going to start with the Einstein-Hilbert action. I is equal to minus 1 over 16 pi integral of r, square root of minus g, d4x plus possible boundary terms, which I'm not going to worry too much about at the moment. To find the charges, I'm going to use the covariant phase space formulation. The reason to use covariant phase space as opposed to canonical methods is that if you use canonical gravity, you're forced to make a choice of the time coordinate, which is difficult. And if you're going to be dealing with null surfaces, will be impossible. So I'm going to use covariant phase-based methods. And these were pioneered by Piles in the early 1950s, and then a whole collection of followers, of which the most prominent are Ashtakar, Witten, Zuckerman, Wald, and collaborators. Who have I forgotten? Well, I guess various collaborators. Him, of Krunkevich, and Wald would be Aya, Lee, and Zupas. So how do you find the charges? Well, the first step is to bury the action. I'm going to send GAB to GAB plus HAB. Then the variation of the action is equal to the integral of HAB times the Einstein tensor plus an integral over the boundary of something called theta A d sigma A. Theta A is usually called the presymplectic potential. And the one way to think about this is you can just think of this as being the sum over pi delta qi. If you're doing something canonical, that's what you'd have as the boundary term. It would just be the sum over all canonical momenta times the variation of the canonical coordinates. So that's how you want to think of theta. An explicit formula for theta is easy to write down and is important. So theta A is going to be a functional of G, the metric of the background, and the perturbation H, and explicitly is equal to 1 over 16 pi times del B H A B minus del A of H, H being the trace of H A B using the metric G. It's more convenient to think of this as a three form, so you just simply say that theta as a three form, I'll just leave it with no indices, is equal to star of theta A dxA. The next step is to find what's usually called the symplectic form. So the presymplectic form let's call this little omega is going to be a functional of G, H, and an H prime, and it's found by varying theta . I will not write up a formula for that because it's too complicated and won't help you understand what's going on. The symplectic form for general relativity, big omega, a function of G and H prime, is equal to the integral over any Cauchy surface, or I should say partial Cauchy surface, of omega of G and H prime. You want to think of this as being like the sum over all canonical momenta and coordinates delta pi wedge delta qi. Again, I should put that in inverted commas because there isn't really a p in this way of thinking about things. You can see from this formula that it's antisymmetric under the interchange of H and H prime. This object lives in the phase space of the theory. And you should think of it as being a two-form on the phase space. To find a charge, what you do is you take omega. That seems to have taken away my eraser, but I've got two. So let's call this charge delta Q. Put H prime AB equal to del A psi B plus del B psi A. In other words, a pure gauge transformation. Then delta Q, I'll explain why it's called delta Q in a moment, is equal to let's go back a bit. Then omega turns into a boundary integral provided H obeys the linearized equations of motion. And the background G obeys Einstein's equations. Then you'll discover a formula for delta Q zeta. It's the integral over the boundary of sigma of delta N minus I zeta of theta, the presymplectic potential. And I have to tell you what N is. N is the dual of the Noether 2 form. And delta means you take the variation of it. That's N. So it's a nice, simple, compact formula. The reason that you write delta Q is it means the change in charge conjugate to zeta. It's a functional of G and H. Change in charge conjugate to zeta between G and G plus H. The trouble with this is that it doesn't always work. Any old zeta, any old diffeomorphism, would appear to have a charge conjugate to it. But there is a consistency condition, and that is that this thing must be a function of state. In the language of symplectic geometry, basically this is saying that this object had better be exact as a two-form. on phase space. There's a quick and dirty way of making that, checking that whether that's true, and it simply says that this thing, if you make a further variation where you send G to G plus K subsequently, this thing had better be the same as G plus K times H. In other words, it's independent of the path. So, examples of this. Well, Komar integrals are one example. Most quasi-local mass calculations are examples, with the possible exception of Yao's examples, which I don't understand. Supertranslation charges for the BMS group. Even if this does not work, sometimes you can manage to make a modification to make it work. An example of that was the Gibbons-Hawking calculation of the action that you're supposed to put in to generate the Euclidean version of black hole entropy. There is a modification where you simply add a counter term first introduced by Wald and Zupas circumstances, you can guarantee that you have found a sensible charge. So that's how you find charges in general. There is, of course, something which should follow from this. Diffeomorphisms form a Lie algebra. So if I took two diffeomorphisms, zeta and psi, and constructed the Lie bracket of the two, this should be a new diffeomorphism. This should be reflected in the charges. If I take q zeta, q psi, and commute them, I should get q of zeta commutator psi. But there's no guarantee that that's actually the case. I might get an extra term, a central term, which depends only on those two things. If you get a central term, it would be interpreted as an anomaly. In the algebra of diffeomorphisms. let me make one further comment, which is intention. My intention here is to draw an anti-parallel with Nathan's talk yesterday. How do you change one of these soft charges? So to change a Q, and you can do explicit examples at infinity, so something like a super translation charge, what you can do is you can act with a large gauge transformation. This is a gauge transformation. It will be at infinity. It's a gauge transformation that does not die off at infinity. So this is an example of a gauge transformation that does make physical sense. There is a simple example, which is provided by this. Where there'd be no observers in the universe, and this plane here was infinite, and I put this here and move it a little bit, that's a translation. It's just a gauge transformation. However, we'd all say that this was a physical effect for the simple reason that there is an observer outside the system that has watched the translation take place. So that kind of relationship between the environment and the system is an example of a physical gauge transformation, and those are the things that you have to be careful of. That doesn't say anything about what happens in the interior. You've got to have an observer external to the thing. So I believe there's no contradiction, just what's usually assumed. So now let's do an example. I could say more about that later if there is time, which there isn't, it would seem. So let's look at the Kerr black hole. I'm going to do Kerr and not Kerr-Newman because it's easier. Usually you think of doing this in Boyle-Lindquist coordinates, TR theta phi. But for our purposes, these will obscure the physics of what's going on. Let's suppose, however, that there is an inner and outer horizon. That are distinct at r equals r plus and r minus. And I'm going to invent two new quantities, TL and TR, to be r plus plus r minus over 4 pi a, r plus minus r minus over 4 pi a, where a is the rotation parameter of the black hole. Explicitly, r plus and r minus are m plus or minus the square root of m squared minus a squared. And if you're interested in the angular momentum of the black hole, it's j is equal to ma. So that's a starting point. Now I want to invent some new coordinates that will make my life and your life a lot easier. Let's invent a W plus that is equal to the square root of R minus R plus divided by R minus over E to the 2 pi TR minus phi. I'm going to invent a W minus, which is equal to R minus R plus over R minus R minus, E to the 2 pi TL phi minus T over 2M. And I'm going to invent a Y, which is equal to R plus minus R minus over R minus R minus, E to the pi T left plus T right times phi minus T over 4M. I'm not going to tell you how I got those.
Y blows up at the horizon?
Oh, no, it's R minus on the bottom. So W plus and W minus are going to zero on the horizon. Near the horizon, the metric takes the following form. 4 rho plus squared dW plus dW minus over y squared, plus 16 j squared sine squared theta over rho plus squared y squared dy squared, plus rho plus squared d theta squared, where rho plus squared is r plus squared plus a squared cos squared theta. And then the corrections to this of order W plus or W minus, which I'm not going to go into, but are essential if you want to do a calculation. If you stare at this metric, you will immediately be struck by something. The first thing is you want to look at these formulae here. Phi is periodic with period 2 pi. So that tells you W plus is periodic with period e to the 4 pi squared tr. W minus is periodic with period e to the 4 pi squared tl. And y is periodic with period e to the 2 pi squared tl plus tr. Were it the case that rho plus and sine theta were constants, you would say, oh, you have found the metric on ADS3. But it isn't, because these are functions of theta, so it's a bit more complicated than that. So it's a warped ADS3. And it's not even a warped ADS3, because you've quotiented out by this thing. You know that these things are periodic, so you have to quotient out by some discrete group. And then we've still got this, so it's some kind of warped circle bundle over this thing. But then you should have some intuition as to what's going on, because your horizon looks a bit like ADS3. So now, we invented some vector fields. We invented two families of vector fields, zeta n, is equal to epsilon n d plus a half epsilon n y d by dy, where epsilon n is equal to 2 pi tr into w plus to the power 1 plus I n over 2 pi tr. And a second vector field, zeta n tilde, epsilon n tilde d minus plus a half epsilon n tilde y d by dy, where epsilon n tilde is 2 pi TL W minus to the 1 plus IN over 2 pi TR. And if you ask what algebra do these vector fields obey, then you get two commuting copies of the Witt algebra. Everybody knows what the Witt algebra is, but possibly not by that name. It's the centerless version of the Virasoro algebra. Now, what one wants to do is to compute the charges. Oh, there is? I mean, I don't have to do that. It's more fun. So, let's see. Where have I got to here? Let's compute K. Well, let's again look at static black hole space-time. It's Kerr, so we have a picture that looks like this. We don't care what goes on beyond here. So I'm going to consider the Cauchy surface like that and compute the central charge that you get with these vector fields. To do that, I have to invent a theta to make it work, and the counter term which works is star QAB N C del B L C DXA, where this is the induced metric on the S2. This is the null generator of H plus, and this is the null generator of H minus, such that k dot n is l dot n is equal to minus 1. Then you can just simply compute two central charges for each of these things, and you will discover that cl equals cr is equal to 12j. You should take comfort from the fact that this depends on j, which is quantized. It cannot be continuously varied. Now, let's recall some prehistory. Press and Yukolsky. They computed scattering cross-sections for particles being thrown into black holes. And let's suppose that we want to throw in a particle of energy delta E and angular momentum whose component is parallel to the spin of the Kerr black hole delta J. Then there is an omega L and an omega R, sort of left and right moving energies associated with their calculations. The first one is 2m cubed over j times delta E, and this one is 2m cubed over j delta E minus delta J. And what they found was that the absorption cross-section contained a lot of geometrical junk, some slowly varying functions of omega, and a 1 plus I omega L with 2 pi t left, square modulus. This is just the usual gamma function. And then a similar one for R. And that's a formula that you've all seen before. This is what you'd expect from amplitudes found in a conformal field theory, where left movers are at temperature TL. And right movers are at temperature TR.
So what was the meaning of this omega L and omega R that they have? What?
These things? Yeah. Just what you get.
Okay, just definitions.
Why? It's just what comes out of the Tucholsky equation. You have to do some hard work to get there. They did, fortunately. That's why that happens. So what do we conclude? If we go back to this picture, then you'd say that an observer sitting in the exterior region would regard the horizon as a boundary, but this boundary would have an anomaly in its diffeomorphism algebra that has to be cancelled by something. So what you're inclined to say is that this surface has on it, to cancel the anomaly, a two-dimensional conformal field theory on sections of the horizon. Described by left movers and right movers, both with central charge 12J, and I can tell you no more about the nature of this conformal field theory. But it is presumably a holographic theory, because you only regard this as a boundary of space-time if you are an observer that sits in the exterior region, the domain of outer communication. If you say, well, I'm interested in falling into the black hole, well, you do something like that, and you certainly would not regard this as a boundary of the space-time. You would presumably fall through it. If you did that, you fall freely through the horizon. You don't see any Hawking radiation. This is presumably somehow connected with Hawking radiation. And so you just say, well, nothing happens. And that's why you regard this thing as holographic. It is an observer-dependent thing, caused by the fact that you are going to sit in the exterior region and regard this as a boundary. Well, you might be inclined to think that that was perhaps a certain amount of science fiction. But John Cardy told you ages ago that provided the central charge is large enough, the entropy of a conformal field theory was equal to pi squared over 3 times c left, t left, plus c right, t right. What is that quantity? Well, we know c left and c right, it's 12j. If we think of this thing as a central charge, we know from Zamenhof it should not be continuously variable. And it is not. It's 0 mod 6. It doesn't depend on the mass, which is continuously variable. So that is comforting to make this interpretation as being associated with a CFT. T left and T right were R plus or minus R minus. Sorry, R plus plus or minus R minus over 4 pi A. And if you substitute all those things in, you will discover this is a quarter of the area of the event horizon. So for that reason, you should believe that this actually is the origin of black hole entropy. It is, however, not what the New York Times said we had done, which is solve the information paradox.
Sorry, could I ask a quick clarification? The J here is the
angular momentum of the black hole.
But for Schwarzschild, it's zero.
Zero. Ah, you're going to ask me about...
Yeah.
Oh, that's all right. CL is 12J, which is 12 MA. TL is R plus plus R minus, which is M, over 2 pi A. So although A is going to 0, you get lucky. Now, it is luck because the Cardia formula only works for large central charge. Make of that what you will. So, why isn't this a solution of the information paradox? It might be the beginning of a solution to the information paradox. The information paradox consists of looking at what happens when a black hole evaporates. And the best thing to do is to draw the what's usually called the red herring diagram, because it looks a bit like a fish. So here is the Hawking radiation. You think of an initial state here and a final state here. So to solve the information paradox, all of the information about a quantum state must reside on the surface of the black hole at some point. In other words, can you reconstruct the initial state from a notion of what the soft hair is? And I don't know the answer to that. In the restricted case of electrodynamics, with one species of particle, you can actually do that for the Schwarzschild black hole and reconstruct the quantum state of single particles falling in, but I'm not clear about multi-particle states. But you've got to do it for all of it. Where there are any global symmetries, there's absolutely no chance of being able to do that. Only if there are local symmetries for anything associated with gauge transformations of this type, do you stand a hope of being able to do that. So that's one up for string theory. But suppose that was true. You've got to see how the information comes out in the Hawking radiation on the assumption that there is nothing left. So that's the minimal thing that you've got to do. You also have to explain why, if I throw something in, at least classically it falls off the edge of space-time, which doesn't seem like a nice thing to do, but if it's supposed to leave an imprint on the horizon, you have got to explain why the no-cloning theorem, its conditions don't apply. You still have a puzzle, because the entropy, a quarter of the area of the event horizon, does not depend on the spectrum of elementary particles. However, if you ask yourself how many different ways could you have engineered this kind of gravitational collapse to find a black hole, you would have said, well, it depends on the number of species of elementary particles in some complicated way. If there were a million times more species than there are, then you'd expect a corresponding growth in S, and that doesn't happen. So the question is, why not? That's usually called the species problem. And lastly, you would be faced with the end point of evaporation. A future, an event horizon cannot have a future end point. In other words, this point is a naked singularity, at least in classical physics. And so you'd have to explain why that does not mess up the evolution to its future. So there are a few challenges that you face if you think this has got anything to do with the information paradox. That does not mean that you should feel pessimistic. It means you should feel amazingly optimistic, because this looks like the kind of story that will go on for many, many years and provide you with decades or possibly centuries of excitement. So let's stop there. Thank you for listening.
Students always go first. Take a question or two from them. They're here. They're busy in lectures. Okay, let's go to PhD students. Don't be shy. Sorry, this is a naive question. Could you explain why J is 0.6?
The spin of elementary particles is 0, 1/2, 1, 3 halves, 2, etc.
So
it's 12J is 0 mod 6.
Just because the black hole's quantum, not because it's
classical? No, because angular momentum is quantized. That's it. In four dimensions. I'm sorry?
It's 12J that's 0.
Yes, 12J is 0 mod 6.
So, in the old KCFT literature, there was this, so people knew how to get this formula for the thermal partition function for 2D CFT, or the thermal cross section for 2D CFT, but they couldn't quite tell where it lived. Is one way of seeing the more recent developments the same? No, we actually do know where it lives.
Well, the calculation that I did really lives on the bifurcation surface. Okay. However, there is some evidence that the same thing will happen all the way up H plus or H minus, but I don't want to go into that right now. That's because it's not, some part of the calculation has not been done, so it might not work. Of course it will work, but that's not quite the same thing.
Any other students? Yes.
Doesn't matter.
So the adding the Walt Dompas counter term is well motivated when you require the delta Q to be exact.
Yes.
What's the physical interpretation of this term?
Okay, so in the case that they looked at, the physical motivation was that they wanted to exclude the possibility of radiation escaping from the bits of the space-time that they were looking at. So they did explicit calculations on Scribe Plus. So it is in their unique paper, since they only wrote one paper. So you can find a description of it there. But it's clearly a more widely... It's something you have to do in more cases than just that. So if you look at section 5.2 of their paper, you will find a general description of the problems that they face, but they only did an explicit example for the case of radiating space-times. We are currently trying to produce a more coherent version of how to find big theta under a wide range of circumstances, but at the moment we are a bit bogged down, partly by the fact there are too many other things to do at the same time. But we should be able to provide you with something within the next 6 months or so, I should think.
Yes, I was just about to ask you, what are the consistency conditions to choose?
Oh, the answer is that Q has got to be an exact form on the phase space. It's as simple as that.
Is a big theta unique, or are there many choices?
Big theta unique.
Do they lead to the same?
Oh, well, it's very interesting. So for the case of Kerr, I actually found two that worked. But
they gave the same answer.
But although we haven't written it yet, only one of them works for Kerr ADS. So that's probably the right one. Regrettably, it's not the one that's in our paper.
Recently, a physical momentum paper was published. They used the first event gravitational wave detection event merging of two black holes.
Right.
They looked at the ring down phase, and they failed to prove the law of the ignoring electric charge. What is your opinion?
Well, I have no idea how they could possibly have proved the no-hair theorem experimentally, for the following reason. They did it by matching templates of what to expect with the data. But all of the templates were generated by using classical general relativity, and therefore you prove nothing by this. So in particular, although some... notably Stephen Hawking, claimed that the results show that the area theorem was true. It doesn't, because there's no way it could not have been true, given what was being done. You fit the data to things which are generated by general relativity. Now, the expert on this is not me, but sitting in front of me, who I think will tell you more about alternatives to general relativity and what the data there actually shows. Is that a correct statement?
No, I'm not going to say anything.
Oh. No comment.
Well, you may not say anything, but you did write something.
I did write
about it. Schwarzschild curve solutions are vacuum solutions.
Yes.
They're roughly equivalent to the solution of the Laplace equation.
Mm-hmm.
And so all the matter collapses. It ends up at the center of the singularity.
Well, that's true for Schwarzschild. It's not really true for Kerr. Kerr is a bit more complicated because...
So what happens if someone removes the singularity at the centre of your...
Good question. So let's look at the Penrose diagram for Schwarzschild. So I'll just do gravitational collapse because it makes life easier. So the Penrose diagram that you're looking at looks something like this. And in this particular case, the singularity is space-like. Anything falling in past H is inevitably going to reach the singularity. Now let's ask ourselves what the singularity means. It means that the Kretschmann scalar, which looks like m squared over r to the sixth, blows up. But mathematically, so mathematicians and physicists have two different ways of talking about this. So let's suppose that I'm a mathematician for the moment. We could argue about that. You would say that, well, what you have to do is to cut out this thing and construct a boundary around it. Then what happens to the red line is it just simply falls off the edge of space-time. I have no idea what that means. But the mathematical part of me says that's what happens in classical general relativity. Now, the physicist would turn around and say, well, that's obviously nonsense. You can't have singularities. Lots of counterexamples, fluid mechanics. Of course, you get singularities in Navier-Stokes, but you know that's because you've treated fluid as a continuum. What happens here? What happened to Clue? So I'll stop.
No answer. Okay.
Yes.
So one thing I'm a bit puzzled about is that you're assuming that, I guess you're kind of hypothesizing based on this, zeta that you generated there, that there's a conformal symmetry, right? Or I guess, are you proving that there's a conformal symmetry, or?
No, I'm saying it's the only way I know of explaining the anomaly and making it go away.
Okay. So now what I'm thinking is that so you had this periodic space-time, periodic phi, and periodic t if you make it Euclidean. Doesn't that break the conformal symmetry? Because that introduces a scale.
Well, you're thinking about... Are you thinking about Schwarzschild or something like that in complex, or are you thinking about the Euclidean field theory?
I'm thinking about Euclidean field
theory. In Euclidean field theory, you see, there isn't a horizon. So there isn't really a space-time. Let's look at the situation a little more carefully. So here is Euclidean Schwarzschild.
I was talking about your W plus W minus coordinate.
Oh. Yeah. Well, those are sort of null coordinates. So you can't... The point is that in W plus W minus, there's a DW plus DW minus
right.
plus DY squared
right.
plus something. But this has got indefinite signature.
Yeah.
So this has always got plus minus. So there's no Euclidean version of this thing.
But I think he was asking why does the scale... CFT should be scale invariant. And
right.
There is a scale.
I see what you mean.
So how does that work?
The CFT can well be scale invariant, but the scales... TL and TR provide scales for you, the temperatures, naturally, but they come from an external source. Similarly, C left and C right, these things are 12J. That's something which is external to this, but it's simply a characteristic of the conformal field theory. It's its central charge. It's just a number. In my dimensionless units, that works fine. This does tell you about the violation of conformal invariance. Central charges are about that. That's why they have to be cancelled. So the only scale comes from the temperatures.
Experiment of physics. Conformal symmetry has to be broken. What happens?
You don't know that on the horizon. By what would it be broken? Remember, it's sections of the horizon, so they're just two spheres. Now, so the argument that you might say, well, geometrically, two spheres got a radius, but you can have a conformal field theory that is scale invariant on a sphere. There's nothing stopping you doing that. The scales come about from T left and T right.
So related to that, like usually you get a central charge, you need like a one-dimensional quantity. I mean, how do you get the central charge from the algebra? Do you usually get integration by part? You have boundary by boundary, and that gives the central charge, right? So are you assuming there is a circle in the sphere where?
There is a sort of implicit circle. Let's look at the nature of these vector fields again. So a sphere has a circle in the sense of its azimuthal angle. So if you look at the zetas, the zeta that I picked was that, and it was epsilon n is 2 pi t right w plus the 1 plus I n over 2 pi t r. So that is diffeomorphisms of w plus, which is, remember, a periodic object because it was identified with period e to the 4 pi squared t right.
So it's a singularity in the parameter, basically.
Yep. But there's nothing pathological about those vector fields on the sphere.
Okay, I think let's call this to a close.